everyone. My name is Julia Przedworski, but I go by Jules, and I have the opportunity to present today some work that I did as part of the 2013 Summer Institute at Fenway. And disclaimer, it's been a long few days, so my energy is not going to match anybody else's energy, so bear with me. It's been a long day. Also, I really liked Sean's point about sort of discussing the perspective we're coming from. So I'm in health policy and management, sociology of health and illness, and I'm really interested in this idea of provider contributions to disparities and what we can do to really get providers to offer better care and to be better at what they do. So with that said, I'm going to be talking about gender identity disclosure within the context of healthcare encounters. So we know, and these are data from the NTDS, National Transgender Discrimination Survey, that trans people experience healthcare discrimination. 28% reported providers discriminating against them. A staggering 19% reported being refused care due to their transgender identity. And then we also know that trans people will often delay care, both preventative and curative, out of fear of discrimination. So the idea of disclosure to a provider is a very fraught decision because on the one hand, it increases the risk of discrimination. But on the other, sort of from the doctor-patient communication literature and from some other literature, we know that sharing not only medically pertinent information but information that sort of affirms people's identities can really promote higher quality healthcare interactions, better doctor-patient communication, and more appropriate treatment recommendations. So sort of given this background, sort of given my interest, what I really wanted to look at was how does provider discrimination impact trans patients' communication and with unknown providers, with healthcare providers that they might be encountering the first time. And I also wanted to look at how provider disclosing to a provider might impact actual care recommendations or treatment that trans patients receive. Also, I should say that I used a lot of pictures from Fenway, which are fabulous. So credit there. I should have had a little credit to Fenway under each of them. So to the data that I used were from the Transgender Health Initiative Survey, which was a cross-sectional survey of a community sample of transgender Virginian adults. Self-identification as transgender, and of 350. This is slightly older data. It's conducted in 2005, 2006. But given that we don't have that much data out there, all data is good. That's my theory. And this was a bimodal survey. So just a little bit about the sample. Again, it's 350 total N. This is the overall race and ethnicity breakdown. So it's about two-thirds white, a quarter African-American, 9% other, 4% Latino. And then there were no significant differences between trans men and trans women in terms of race and ethnicity. Educational attainment, we have about a third have a college degree, about a fifth have high school diploma or less, and then the remainder have some college. Here we did find differences between trans women and trans men, with more trans women reporting a high school degree or less. The mean age for the sample was 31 years old, and trans women were older than the trans men in the sample. We did not find a significant difference between trans women and trans men in terms of insurance. However, the insurance rate was really high, which is unsurprising given what we know and given the barriers that trans populations experience in trying to obtain health insurance for numerous reasons. Okay, so now to the analysis and the nerdier stuff. So to actually test the associations, and I'll get into a little bit more of the variables in a second, we conducted generalized linear model analyses to get estimated relative risks, and I am a big fan of relative risks because they're more intuitive to me. And then I will be presenting today the adjusted analyses, so not the unadjusted, but the covariates that the adjusted analyses included were age, insurance status, race, education, survey modality, and sex assigned at birth. And then we also conducted an additional stratified analysis where we looked separately at trans men and trans women. Okay, so those two research questions, how were they actually operationalized? So the independent variable for the first question, whether provider discrimination impacts disclosure and communication with future providers. The independent variable is, have you ever experienced discrimination by a doctor due to your transgender status or gender expression? So here we have a clear sort of attribution of provider discrimination to a particular, to gender identity. It was a dichotomous variable, and we excluded those who reported don't know or unsure. The dependent variable here was, how comfortable would you be discussing your transgender status under transgender-related healthcare needs with a doctor you did not know? And this was a scale answer, and we dichotomized this very comfortable, comfortable to very uncomfortable and uncomfortable. So this is sort of getting at this kind of communication. It's a question trying to measure not only disclosure, but also how comfortable do you really feel with an unknown provider? Okay. So I'm going to present data in two-way because I'm a visual person more. So here is a table, sort of standard of what we're used to. Those respondents who reported past provider discrimination were also more likely, had a greater risk of saying that they would be uncomfortable disclosing their trans status with an unknown provider. And then when we stratified that, finding that association was only significant for trans women. And then here, graphs and prettier colors. So here you see that this is for the overall sample. The blue line sort of, so for folks who experience provider discrimination, 26% greater likelihood of saying that they'd be uncomfortable disclosing trans status or transgender-related healthcare issues with an unknown provider. Here's a stratified analysis. So here again, sort of you see that it's trans women are, we only find a significant association in stratified analysis for trans women. Second question. So here looking at disclosure and HIV screening. So independent variable was operationalized. Are you out to your doctor? Yes or no. Very straightforward. And then we excluded those who did not have a current provider. And our dependent variable was, have you ever had an HIV test? Yes or no. And here, again, we tables first, but being out to your current provider increased likelihood of being tested for HIV. And actually, these p-values are lies. I'm sorry. The p-value for the main overall sample is 0.05, and the results were, again, only significant for trans women, and the results, the p-value there is actually 0.039. Sorry, I was supposed to fix that, and I forgot. Again, let's present this visually, graphically. So again, those folks who were out to their provider were more likely to have an HIV test. And again, it was only significant for trans women when we stratified. So the sort of takeaway from this, that provider discrimination and how providers treat their patients can have a long-lasting impact, and then how those patients interact with the healthcare system. And this should be a concern for all providers, because providers like to think that they, you know, provide same care to everyone, but they don't realize, or they don't want to realize oftentimes that they are being very discriminatory to their patients. Thank you. This data also suggests that there might be some differences in the treatment recommendations that providers might be giving to their trans patients based on whether the provider knows whether the person is trans or not. Now, this study has a number of limitations. So it's cross-sectional, so non-generalizable. It's a community sample. It's geographically limited, small sample sizes, relatively speaking. The big issue for me here is measurement validity. This survey was, again, sort of designed to meet state and community needs, so it's not necessarily, questions aren't designed here for research, and I think we have to be very respectful of that and sort of be humble and be like, yes, we thank you for letting us use the data. I'm not going to complain too much about that. But it does definitely sort of, the temporal order here can be questionable. You know, this is a cross-sectional study. We don't know, you know, the first question, we have some temporal order built into the questions themselves. Have you experienced discrimination in the past? are you going to be uncomfortable in the future? We can make a temporal order argument there. The second question where we really can't, are you out to your current provider? Have you ever had an HIV test? However, the importance of that is, so we don't really know what's going on, but this sort of gets to the implications that more research is needed. And when I was creating these slides, I wanted to have like a big flashing more needed, because we just really do. We don't know really what's going on, but we know that we're seeing these disparities. We know that we are seeing that there's healthcare inequity going on. There are a number of data that are showing this, but we really need to start delving into what exactly is going on in these healthcare encounters. Implications for practice, we really need interventions to improve physicians' ability to provide knowledgeable, sensitive, and gender identity affirming and trans-affirming care to their trans patients. I should have done this in the beginning because everyone else did their disclosures in the beginning. I have none. But I do have funding. I want to acknowledge the Fenway Summer Institute, which was fantastic and wonderful, and their funding, as well as my funding from the National Cancer Institute, and also collaborators on this paper, and the folks from Fenway Institute who are in the audience. And that's it. Thank you so much.
Questions? Yeah?
Mostly a question of clarification.
Sure. The question is, are you out to your provider? And so arguably, we can't know that for sure. It's within the context of, you know, this is a transgender health survey. But that's a measurement sort of validity issue, absolutely. It could just be that it's out about sexual orientation. I'm looking at you because you know these data, too.
Yeah,
Sari has published on these data,
I thought it's all actually, it's contextualized.
Yeah, and
I'll... You would make an attribution that it was sexual.
That was really the sexual orientation related to gender.
Yeah, it would be very unlikely.
Okay, all right. Yeah.
Thank you, Dan.
This was a study done by the state of Virginia in 2009?
Five and six.
Five and six?
Mm-hmm.
I live in Florida. There's not been one study yet. So it's just shocking to me that the state of Virginia, who I don't... but that they subsidize a statewide study through the Department of Health, that's what you're saying this is? You know, I'm from the dark ages, so we did it differently, but that's just so I understand.
Yeah.
This was subsidized by the Department of Health in 2009.
I think this is an interesting conversation, and it relates to the fact that it was from their HIV money. So, in general,
mm-hmm.
As part of the Ryan White service.
Yeah.
What, like, the general fund that didn't see it?
This would never happen.
Yeah.
The back?
Yeah.
So I'm one of the people that helped push that.
Oh!
So it was really a wonderful collaboration of community folks, because it really was community-based.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm not going to ask something, and now I might ask it of both of you, but just seeing this, I'm a provider myself, and I've done research in this area, and there's a lot of pushback on any provider education for many, many reasons. And one is we provide the same care to everyone, right? Like, this is pervasive. It's just the ideal, which we're very brainwashed with that being the ideal. But in just doing review of the literature and that sort of thing, did you see any interventions where people are really going after any provider aspect? Even if that's part of the thing, the community to educate their own providers from somewhere and need advocates. I just wonder what are your all thoughts on how do we do that? And then even community coalitions. Mm-hmm. I don't think that anybody's like focusing on the only part that they're doing.
Right. That's, I think, the issue. There are a lot of really great initiatives that a number of community organizations are doing, even in Minnesota. You know, there are trainings that are for providers. Very little is actually published on this. And it's simply, you know, we have the barriers and sort of the academia and classist barriers that a lot of community organizations must contend with, that that's not a form, you know, sort of this vicious cycle of we only recognize peer review stuff, but then we make entry into a peer review journal so difficult and insurmountable that it's hard for a lot of community organizations to publish these data and get it out there about the interventions. But I also wanted to comment on your point about sort of the provider saying we treat everyone the same. You know, another project that I'm involved in is looking at explicit and implicit bias, racial, body size, and LGB bias of medical students against patients, and sort of using, you know, this study to not only predict changes in implicit bias, but also just to convince the audience that there are biases and this does have an effect on healthcare disparities. We have time and time again shown that there are disparities in the way providers provide care based on what the patient looks like, based on the provider's perspective on what they think they know about the patient. So a lot of it is educating providers and medical schools about, you know, we have to get away from this narrative that, you know, not only are all patients the same and all patients should be treated the same, as this is something that's actually of value. Part of it is also getting, like, we have this narrative also of cultural competency that somehow, you know, we just train a bunch of facts versus there's also this push about creating more empathy, more humanization within, you know, teaching providers to be more empathetic and, you know, individualized care, sort of, you know, so actually changing the entire perspective on how care is provided and how we train providers versus saying, you know, you just have to learn this list of all these facts about this population and you'll be able to provide ideal care. So that's sort of another issue around changing narratives. Right, right. Or cultural humility instead of cultural competence, you know, things like that.
In the back?
I
see one more hand. Yep.
Or you don't have other options. So I think that there's absolutely a sort of a multi-pronged
approach here, but I'm really glad to hear you say it. And, you know, as a writer, you want to know where that information is.
Okay, one more.
I was going to say that, you know, we're in the middle of that. We're in Los Angeles, and we're in the middle of trying to train our wellness center, our school-based health clinics, and the advisors on our campuses. We try to train them on how to be friendly, how to be wellness center friendly, how to be trans friendly, and so it's a difficult process because many of them think they already do, and many of them are not. Many of them are not consistent, and many of them do not have the proper intake paperwork. Many of them do not have the proper medical records set up to do things correctly. Many of them do not have the frontline staff and the vocabulary to use. And so we had to come in and contract with other CBOs to come in or other state agencies to come in and really train them well enough to understand that language and get people together in these providers so that it's all the pieces of it. So it's not just like one piece, it's many pieces that have to work together from the MR to the frontline staff to the vocabulary to the physical environment. And creating an assessment checklist, and we've had to do that with creating a checklist to go in. So we created, what we did is we started off with a webinar, finding a champion from that center or that clinic, and then from there, I'm creating an assessment piece, and from there, going to the technical assistance to make sure that they're following from that assessment what they need to do, and then figure out what kind of work we do with the physical environment versus what we do with the MR, the tech people, and things like that. So it's a huge system that employers make sure across the board. All those things are happening because even if you have some provider things consistently happening, even with the language going on, sometimes they can track medically and how they deal with that patient because it's not tracked medically, it's in the paperwork electronically even, then that patient not treated well or correctly or appropriately or what have you.
Thank you.
Thank you.